Good evening and welcome to Cure Talk. I'm Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. And this evening on Cure Talk's 87th episode and our third talk on fertility and reproduction, we are discussing psychosocial and emotional aspects of infertility and deciding about the remaining embryos. Mayo Clinic defines the disease of infertility as the inability to conceive despite having frequent unprotected sex for at least a year for most people and 6 months if the woman is above 35 years of age, or the inability to carry a pregnancy to live birth. Being diagnosed with infertility may take one on a roller coaster of emotions: embarrassment, shame, guilt, grief, inadequacy, and hope, and then a disappointment every month. These are the feelings that one fights through when dealing with infertility. Infertility may be like a dementor, if you will, that soaks up all the hopes and happiness around and pull people down the abyss of depression, guilt, and sorrow so deep that the sufferers tend to lose self-confidence, stop socializing and making friends, and in some extreme cases find themselves just incapable of sustaining daily lives. According to the CDC's 2006-2010 National Survey of Family Growth, one in eight women are going through similar pains of not being able to conceive or sustain a pregnancy to term and build their families. Unfortunately, the stigma attached to this issue makes it all the more difficult for the sufferers because they do not open up and share the emotional trauma that they are going through. To do our bit to help those searching for valuable information on this issue and with the hope of giving hope to those going through the pains of infertility, we launched our talk series on fertility and reproduction last year in July, where we intend to discuss topics ranging from actual medical issues involved to the emotional aspects of infertility with our invited experts and panelists. On our first show, we had Dr. Musa Shamonki of UCLA, who discussed the risk factors associated with infertility in men and women. We also discussed fertility preservation in young adult cancer survivors with Sudeka Jaud and Dr. Anjay Ray this March. In this series today, to discuss the psychosocial and emotional aspects of infertility, we have with us our very distinguished guest and eminent expert, Helen Adrian, who is a psychotherapist and is in private practice since 1979. Helen, who is called the master of her craft, specializes in working with men, women, and couples dealing with infertility and conducts mind-body stress reduction classes for the NYU Fertility Center. Helen is a charter member of the New York City Resolve and educates mental health professionals on the parameters of infertility. She is also trained in clinical hypnotherapy, teaches hypnosis, and is an approved consultant for the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. Helen has authored many articles on infertility, which are available on her website, www.mind-body-unity.com, and her blogs. Her book, On Fertile Ground, Healing Infertility, is launched as number one bestseller on Amazon and is available there. Welcome to Cure Talk, Helen.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to have been invited.
Great. We also have Amy Dema, an experienced New York licensed attorney and founder of Law Offices of Amy Dema, providing services to those engaged in assisted family building, specifically egg, embryo, and known sperm donation, as well as compassionate surrogacy. She is also a fellow of the American Academy of Art Attorneys and an active member of the Legal Professionals Group of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. She is also a legal advisor to parents via egg donation and to the Society of Ethics in Egg Donation and Surrogacy. Amy is actively engaged in the nation's most established infertility patient advocacy groups and other nonprofit and professional organizations. She served for many years as vice president on the board at Resolve New England, and in 2012 completed her tenure as president on the board of directors at Resolve New England. Welcome to Cure Talks, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
My co-host this evening is Fran Meadows, Fran is an author and infertility advocate and became a mom through IVF to her one son. Meadows is one of many women that struggled with infertility and the devastation of a late pregnancy loss. She works with women fighting infertility by providing hope, inspiration, and strength, and a friend to lean on. She has authored the book titled The Truth Behind the Secret Infertility. Supporting us on the panel is Candace Wall, an infertility blogger and survivor who became a mother through the gift of surrogacy after 7 long years of struggle. Candace and her husband started their blog called Our Misconception in 2012 to overcome the adversity and stare infertility directly in the face with humor and positivity. The couple was also featured on MTV's True Life documentary named I'm Desperate to Have a Baby. Candace works closely and volunteers for the nonprofit organization Resolve for Infertility Advocacy and has written various articles featured on the Huffington Post, Still Standing Magazine, FertilityAuthority.com, Surrogacy Pride, Adoption.net, and various other online sites. I extend a hearty welcome to all the panelists and to all our listeners. Before we dive into the questions, I would like to remind our listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. You can email your questions to priya@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask them. With this, I hand over to Fran Meadows to take the discussion forward. Fran, over to you now.
Thank you, Shweta, for the wonderful introduction, and I'm excited to be here co-hosting the show tonight. It's a great honor to be here with the wonderful experts and panelists. Thank you, Helen, thank you, Amy, and thank you, Candace, for being here tonight. We're going to be discussing a very important topic, and I think it's something that is where we need to educate people, because I know myself going through infertility and being there and knowing what needs to be done, you never really think about what the future brings when it comes to legal aspects of embryos. And I think that's where we're going to, you know, get a lot of great information from Amy as well as Helen on the emotional aspect side and the mental health side. So for you, Helen, I'm going to begin. Thank you again for being here tonight.
It's my pleasure.
And, I mean, like I said, I know when I was diagnosed with infertility, it was difficult to hear the diagnosis. And, I mean, my journey going from infertility to being pregnant and then experiencing a late loss, it was very difficult and I felt very hopeless. So, I mean, when struggling with infertility, just hearing the diagnosis alone, it could be devastating. And I know with some of your patients, have you encountered patients that have long-term emotional and social effects when faced with a multiple of failed cycles, maybe elevated anxiety and possible miscarriage or loss? Have you had patients, and what tips can you share with us?
Well, this ranks up there as one of the all-time great stressors. It's been measured to elicit stress on the same level as life-threatening illnesses such as cancer, HIV, AIDS. And so this is not for the lily-livered. You know, this is not Mickey Mouse land at all. Along the way, it is a complete roller coaster ride. That's the common phrase that people use. People feel completely out of control. But I'm kind of interested in providing hope, which is what Shweta had said. And invariably, the crisis gets resolved somehow or another. And once the crisis is resolved, it kind of reminds me of an article that was in the Times not long ago where they were measuring those who were in these wars that we've been involved in. And it turns out that 75% of people who come back from combat do not suffer from PTSD. And when I wrote my book, although it's absolutely true that you can't unhave your history and the black place that you describe going into, Fran, I mean, this is you know, I don't know that there's any way, if you're a feeling human being, that you can just go through it as if you're made out of concrete. And you can't unhave that history. But what I found from the people that I interviewed is that they said things such as, I've graduated now, which is someone who felt that that she could be with her family as she got it. It may not have been with a biological child. It may have been an ovum donation or an adoption, but she had graduated now. On the other hand, there were women who said, well, it's diminished. I have my child, but will I ever have another child? There are people who said unequivocally, yes, I'm on the other side of it. Others who said yes and no, because there are triggers that are inevitable in this process that bring you back to the pain that you suffered. One woman actually was pretty sophisticated. She said, yes, I do feel a leftover unresolved place, but I know it's because I'm a perfectionist. And so she was looking back at her history through the filtration system of a personality trait that she had. The thing, if you want to focus on having hope, you're not going to be in this place forever.
Right. So you feel like, I mean, obviously everybody's experience is individualized and, you know, with different, I guess you say like, you know, you've graduated or this is where my journey ends or I've had my child. So do you feel that people just, you know, couples, they basically have their own way of dealing with the cycle of this particular, you know, conceiving and, you know, cycle here where they deal with it in so many different ways and they heal in different ways?
Yeah. I think that the people who navigate this process by themselves are not people that I see. But the people that I see are, you know, touring the solar system. I mean, they're not even in their bodies. They're just so distraught and so frenzied and so desperate and so panicky and everything else, which is how come I can have a job. And the tools that I teach are extremely effective in getting people who are so desperate and so focused on a goal that they're just, you know, they're not living in their body anymore, get them to come back into the place where they're not donating anywhere from 6 months to 6 years or longer in being in that frenzied place where they can pendulate back and forth between now I'm in a cycle, now the drugs are driving me crazy, now this cycle didn't work, or yay, this cycle did work, or here's a miscarriage, you know, the ups and downs and everything else. And then in between, be able to remember what it was that brought these two people together in the first place and turn them in the direction of what can we do to have fun now, so that we're not donating all of this time to being miserable. It's a real challenge to learn how to live around something as gigantic as the infertility challenge.
Right. And now, since we'll be talking more about the legal side of, you know, these decisions that couples have to make and, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's from, you know, going through infertility or going through your cycles, you go to the other side of it where once you're at a point where maybe you're storing your embryos or you're waiting to mm-hmm. maybe have another child, you know, mm-hmm. these are many decisions that couples may not think when they're in, you know, in the cycle or in the present. I know, you know, mm-hmm, many couples mm-hmm. that don't. So, I mean, with their remaining embryos that they're storing, you know, can this type of decision be stressful or emotional for couples? And mm-hmm. how can you as a mental health professional help them get through these, I mean, even harder decisions here to, make with their remaining embryos?
Decisions of this magnitude are an ordeal to begin with, but when you're dealing with two people who are involved in this decision-making process, one plus one is not two, okay? And I'm not even sure it's three. It could be, you know, even more intense than that. And so the question is, how can two people navigate to the place where they're on the same page. If they're not on the same page, if they are, that's great. And then the waiting game can be nerve-wracking. You know, am I going to conceive again with the frozen embryos? So, you know, what does my future look like? What is my family going to look like? All of these things. But where I come in is to get couples to be able to communicate clearly, and to communicate, I'll say this, purely, right? Because if you're communicating just how you look at things, which is the factual, and how you feel about things, and you're just making statements about it, that's fine. But if you're hurling pots and pans at each other, you know, because you don't know how to be in your skin with these things, then that's where I come along. And if there is not a meeting of the mind, I have a technique that I teach them, which is all about listening. And it's so interesting because when you tell people that they have to listen in a way that they're not allowed to interrupt, they have to be able to repeat back what the other person says, it takes on a whole different cast. And now keep in mind, this may be two people who are not at all on the same page. You may be, if you're listening in on this, saying, well, you know, are they even in the same marriage? Are they in the same situation? It doesn't, you know. But the point is, when they have to repeat back what the other person has said, it forces them to take on the mindset even for those few minutes. And there are times when you're listening to someone say what you just said, where you have the satisfaction of knowing that you were heard, and at times that is as good as it gets, until
right.
things move along in whatever way that circumstances and the unknowns that come up, and the changes of heart and whatever else, where things can come to a resolution.
Right, so communicating together as a couple, or, you know, a partner situation, or
yeah.
any situation, communicating together is a very important thing that you work with, because, like
right.
you said, some might not be on the same page.
And it can be learned. That's the thing to know. It can be learned. I mean, one of the most gratifying aspects of this work for me is when I'm working with a couple who really, even without infertility, don't have the didn't have the role modeling, and therefore don't have the tools to communicate lovingly with each other, and for me to come in and to show them, you know, exactly, you know, we deconstruct their style of communication, we break it down and put it in better terms, and to be able to teach people how to do something that gets them to the end where they're not only communicating better, but they're in a much better position to be appropriate, loving parents and role models for their child, for, you know, how two people talk to each other in a loving way. So
right.
it's very
That's
exciting
such,
for me
yeah.
to be able to help out in this way.
That's such helpful information, I'm sure,
yeah.
for those listening, and it's really helpful. And, I
yeah.
mean, going on now to the legal end of some of the things we've been discussing, we're going to bring Amy on for a couple of questions here. Amy,
mm-hmm.
are you there?
I'm
Hi,
here.
Amy.
Ready and waiting.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you again for being on the show. And, I mean, for me, I can remember when I went for my egg retrieval appointments for my IVF cycle with my husband, and we were giving so many forms to fill out in the office and, you know, so many things on our minds. And I remember wondering that, you know, if I would have any embryos to cryopreserve after retrieval. But I never really thought things further out into the future. And can you share with us some professional advice on embryo preservation and what couples should discuss in order to make decisions when they're at the start of, I guess, their cycle and then moving forward? What could help them?
Yes. So thanks for providing me an opportunity to address this topic. Certainly residual or remaining embryos and the disposition and final decisions around those embryos is a really hot topic, particularly the last 6 to 8 months. We've heard of a lot of high-profile lawsuits around embryos. And I always say to my clients, those high-profile lawsuits look very much like the lawsuits of everyday folks, except they're high-profile parties, right? So it's a some celebrity attachment often, or some of the reason for the media to grab hold of this. But this is common everyday stuff for all of us who are dealing with the world of in vitro fertilization. And you're right, Fran. It is very unsettling for a patient who's about to go in for an egg retrieval to then be, pardon me, handed these forms, typically in a rushed manner, certainly not with the availability of legal counsel, often not with the availability of mental health support, and urged to sign in a not thoughtful but efficient manner. In many instances, in many ways rather, it is the egg donor recipient who is better off in terms of thinking about, deciding about processing through remaining embryos than it is the person who is going through IVF for themselves. When you are going through egg donation, typically, not always, but typically, there is at least a meeting with a mental health professional, required often by the clinic or at least suggested. There also should be, for the most part, egg donation agreements. And when attorneys counsel either donors or recipients before entering into an egg donation arrangement, remaining embryos is something that we speak about. And often, particularly when I'm counseling a donor, and I bring up the issue of remaining embryos, and I let her know that she has discretion, and her discretion will be reflected in the agreement. If she has not yet met with the mental health professional, and I don't like doing legal reviews with donors prior to them having met with a mental health professional, and sometimes I'll end my session with a donor if she's not yet met with a mental health professional. But if she says to me, gee, nobody's ever brought that up to me, then I know that she has not yet had that meeting with the mental health professional. It's a heavy matter to have to think about prior to an IVF cycle, being all the way at the other end of that journey, being done with family building, and still having embryos to contend with. It is an impossible thing often to get recipient parents, intended parents in an egg donation arrangement to prepare for it. However, again, those folks have the benefit of seeing someone like Helen before they'll get to my office, or again, I'll put them on hold and send them back out to Helen and have them come back to me. But IVF patients, myself as well, we don't have that luxury. I never saw a mental health professional in any of my infertility. It wasn't recommended at my clinic. It certainly wasn't required for my cycle. So you're handed these forms, you're asked to sign to make decisions about remaining embryos in the case of a death of a party, a death of both parties, a dissolution of a relationship, for the most part, and these are one-page forms that are checkboxes. If one party passes away, then the other should get the embryos, yes or no. If both parties should pass away, then the embryos will be donated to the clinic, yes or no. So they're short forms. They're handled in quick order. I don't know any clinic that says to their patient, we really want you to sign this informed consent about embryo disposition, but we understand you want to take it home and see your attorney. That's not usually how it happens.
Yeah.
Right. So we don't get to counsel IVF patients, period, end of story. I don't ever have reason to address residual embryos with IVF patients. I only see them when they are working with a donor, and then we very much flush out this issue.
So with patients that are going through IVF, like I said myself, with filling out the forms, are there,
yep.
I mean, is there any type of, because, like, honestly, those check boxes you were just talking about, I mean, I could see them, but I don't remember actually reading them through. It was just like check, rush manner, you know, get things done. Are there any things that you could, you know, recommend, like, I mean, talking about maybe before going for an egg retrieval for a regular IVF cycle, you know, that a couple could talk about these decisions, you know, because check
could
boxes
that
at that time.
Yeah, right. Absolutely, Fran. You are right. We absolutely, the way we give, and there are just so many terrific websites out there, incredible resources that prepare patients for IVF cycles, and yet we talk very little about this matter. And it's a relatively minor matter on the radar when you're going into IVF. It's not a glaring matter. In my experience with egg donor recipients, it becomes a significant matter 3 to 5 years after I have worked with them. So about 2 to 4 years old with whatever child resulted from the egg donation cycle that we worked on, that's when I get the call. And the motivation to address this issue at that point is financial. And it's simply, we've been getting these bills for these storage fees. This is causing me stress. This is causing stress in our lives. We need to resolve these embryos. What can I do? And all I am able to do is provide legal counsel. We are absolutely boxed in to what was agreed to in the egg donation agreement. Did the donor allow for donation of the embryos to someone else for family building, for example? So all I can do is counsel them as per the terms of their agreement. The work that Helen and her colleagues do in this is so weighty and it's so big because having folks make that decision, once the decision is made, I can counsel on how to execute that decision. That's what I do. But getting folks from the we've been in storage for 3 years, we've been in storage for 5 years, we're done with our family building, we can't handle the financial burden. It's a spiritual drain on me, an emotional drain on me. For Helen to get those folks from that point to a point of resolution, that's a lot of work to be done.
Can I just break in here for a second? Because first of all, Amy, I'd like to say how incredibly articulate and succinct you're being on this issue. And the listening audience is really has to be benefiting enormously from this.
Thanks.
Where I come into this, the only thing I'd like to add is that infertility itself is such an ordeal that, you know, as I said, they're spinning around, they're flying in outer space and whatnot, and then you put something like a legal document in front of them. You know, a legal document when you're out having dinner and there's nothing, you know, going on in your life, you're just reading a legal document, your eyes glaze over because what is this, you know, legalese. But then when you're in that state and they hand you a document like this, like Fran said, she doesn't even remember reading the damn thing. You know? So it really ratchets up. It's another thing that puts the stress of infertility in the high category that it's in.
And
right,
just
right.
as an aside, Helen probably, and certainly her colleagues, and this is just a flip side, and we don't have to stay on this side for very long, but it's worth considering or at least discussing. Helen and her colleagues will evaluate and counsel egg donors in anticipation of an egg donation cycle. Imagine how weighty that issue is for a 23-year-old girl who no one has mentioned this topic to them before. It's not been something that they have been told to process through and prepare for, and now there's the reality or the potential of the reality that their genetic material will end up in this cryopreserved form, and decisions will be made about her genetic material 3 to 5 years from. They can't even anticipate that. And these are these are young women who are really not very much looking 5 years out. I mean, it's just not something they're thinking about. So it's complex on both the donor side, complex on the egg donor recipient side, certainly complex on the IVF patient side who does not have the benefit of either legal or mental health counsel.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like I said, this is wonderful information for our listeners because people don't really think about these things when they are in the present. The present moment is rush and, you know, do everything because, you know, I have to get everything done, check the boxes, sign the paper, and go. You know, so, I mean, I think this is really great for patients that might be going through this. And, I mean, in the media, we've been hearing so many stories of legal cases with frozen embryos involved with celebrities, you know, and even everyday couples, because I recently read an article about the Chicago court ruling that a woman whose fertility was destroyed by cancer treatment could use her embryos that she created with her ex-boyfriend. And, you know, it's amazing how many situations are, you know, individually treated now in the courts. And, Amy, I'd love to hear what you thought about that, you know, ruling and how you could, you know, explain how different, you know, situations are individualized, you know, in the courts now.
Yep. So, thank you. Before we get to that case, and I very much look forward to discussing it with you, it's the ruling in Chicago that allowed the woman to use the embryos despite the objection of the partner with whom she created the embryos. That's a ruling that just came down this week. And we're not surprised by it because of some other recent rulings, but it is a shift in how embryos are being, battles for uses of embryos is being addressed in the court. A significant shift. And we'll talk about that shift in just 1 minute. But let me just lay the foundation. What are the disposition options? And someone who has cryopreserved embryos has five, perhaps six, options for them. They can keep them frozen indefinitely. And if you're willing to pay a storage facility to keep your genetic material frozen, I'm sure they're happy to accept your check. The particular clinic where you created the embryos may have a time limit simply because they probably have space limitations. So after 3 years, they may ask you to move your embryos to another facility. But if you wanted to keep them frozen indefinitely, frankly, I don't think you'd have a problem of finding a facility who would be able to issue long-term storage services. So freeze them impractical, certainly. Certainly, I would imagine tons of screaming sirens going off right now for Helen, for somebody to think to carry that burden long-term. But from a practical perspective, it is a disposition option. One can choose to do that should one decide to. Another option is destruction. So you call the clinic and you ask them to allow the embryos to thaw until they are no longer viable. That's a tough one. I'm not even going to begin to unpack that. Helen, I'm sure, will do a terrific job in talking to us about that. But those of us who have been through IVF and have created our own embryos know from the bottom of our heart how difficult it is to come to that disposition option. It is an option for some. There are folks who resolve in that regard, no doubt with the help of mental health support. But nonetheless, it is there. In my experience in counseling recipients of donor eggs, it is the least opted for disposition option in terms of the clients that I see. The next option is donation for research. That's a very appealing option until we find out that at this present time, and this is a matter of the economy, this is a matter of politics, there are tons of cultural influences, but at this particular time, it is very hard to find research facilities who will take embryos for medical or scientific research. A couple of years ago, it was easier. Right now, it's tough. I always tell my clients to go right back to the clinic where the embryos were created. In my experience, they will be the most likely party who are willing to accept the embryos and have them used for fertility research. So that's another option. Obviously, using the embryos is an option for your own family building. The presumption is you've reached a point that you're done with your family building by the time you're calling me. Donating remaining embryos to someone else for family building, embryo donation, a beautiful family building option. I love working on embryo donation cases. I wish there were more of them. Also a very weighty emotional and psychological matter because children resulting from that embryo donation are full genetic siblings to the donor's children, and that, too, is a very weighty and complex matter to have to process and resolve.
Right.
There is another option. I don't hear much of it recently, not in the last several years. I wish we did. And frankly, in my heart, I always thought it was a lovely way to resolve. And that is a transfer done when there is no likelihood of a pregnancy. I think it's lovely, and I just don't know how many clinics are offering them. So those are your disposition options. Lawyers stay involved when there is an embryo donation. Sometimes I will just hold my client's hand as we look for a facility to accept donated embryos for research. The other disposition options are elected outside of the attorney's office. So you don't need to work with an attorney if you're doing any of the other disposition options. But certainly if you're donating to someone else for family building, then we've got a draw up document. So so there you are. Those are disposition options. What we are finding in the court and the scenarios that come to the public attention are when husbands and wives or the parties that came together to create the embryos are now no longer in agreement about disposition options. And one of the triggers for lawsuits is one party wants to use them and the other party doesn't want to use them. And historically, courts have held that a party's right not to parent trumped a party's right to parent. And it's because of financial obligation. So child support is not something. So I have lots and lots of intended mothers, or rather mothers who want to use embryos. They come forward and say, look, I don't want any money from you. You don't have to pay child support. You don't need to be responsible for any financial obligation. Well, the law doesn't allow that. Child support is something that belongs to the child and only the child. No parent can waive child support. So you can't relieve the other party from child support. Only the child can do that. And so the courts have said, well, since there's no relief, we can't unburden this. We can't burden this person with parenting. So really, truly, historically, for a number of years, a long time, that was solid legal ground. The party who doesn't want to have the embryos result in a life to whom he or she would have any financial or other obligations always won these lawsuits.
Right.
Now we're seeing a shift.
I'm going to bring on Candace Wohl because she has a few questions for Helen and Amy as well, and I'd love to, you know, see if she's going to go further into those questioning, Amy, so you could discuss it more.
Sure.
Candace, welcome to the show, and I would love for you to, you know, give two questions to Helen and then two questions to Amy so they could further discuss this conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And wow, thank you so much for having us. And there was a lot of great conversation points that are brought up. So my head is kind of swimming as to where to start. So, you know, since we're on the topic, Amy, I would like to start with you. I have a different spin on things. So I, too, was like Fran. I had multiple IVFs. I had six. And really, we didn't pay that much attention to those consent forms. The main point that I did pay, I guess, the most attention to is what if something happened to my husband, but not if we were to, not if our marriage was to disband. So it's interesting because you focus on a specific area, but those are things that you don't really consider. And then our journey kind of transitioned where I had two remaining embryos, but no longer did I have a uterus to transfer them to because I had a hysterectomy. Huh. And so we were in that weird situation of what do we do? So we actually did hang on to ours, but we were lucky in the fact that our clinic is one of the few that does research, and you can donate those embryos to research. But for some reason, I held on to them. And fast forward a little bit longer, I had then had our daughter through the gift of surrogacy. So this is a different topic that I'm going to challenge you with, because even though every state is about as clear as mud when it comes to surrogacy law, and I know that New York is a very challenging one in the fact that their contracts are considered void and unenforceable. There are also fines, from my knowledge, that are enforced for those who arrange and assist in surrogacy agreements. I believe it's anywhere from $500 to $10,000. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
That law also states that no person can pay or accept money in relation to a surrogacy agreement except for medical expenses. So my question is, how does an intended parent who is a New York resident go about navigating an out-of-state surrogacy if their embryos are created and housed in the state of New York?
Yep.
And additionally, does the New York state laws flex for this type of scenario?
Yep. So actually, the roadblock for New Yorkers is relatively low, I'm happy to tell you. So yes,
that's good.
In states like New York, and New York Michigan, state of Washington, and there's a fourth, where actually commercial surrogacy, compensated surrogacy, is criminal activity. So in New York, it's a felony.
Okay.
Punishable by fine and prison, same as the case in Washington State, same as the case in Michigan. And I'm forgetting my fourth, and I usually know this off the tip of my fingers. But
it's
you're right.
Arkansas
so,
or Arizona. It's one
so
of those
there
two.
Are, yeah, it might be Arizona. There are states that have actually crystal clear surrogacy law, and then there are states that the New York law is pretty clear. I mean, there's nothing muddy about the New York law. You will not be building your family in a lawful manner if you're engaged in paid surrogacy in New York. However, I started off with the roadblock actually is pretty low. All New Yorkers need to do, and I should say that with more sensitivity. Yes, there is a burden to having to leave your home state to build your family. I understand that, and I acknowledge that. Once one has decided that that's just part of the journey, New Yorkers can and do leave the state. They go as close as Connecticut, and without any legal hurdles, can pursue family building through surrogacy with their embryos. So it is simply a matter of crossing state lines into a surrogacy-friendly state. Once you're in a surrogacy-friendly state, it is irrelevant the state in which the embryos are created, and it is irrelevant the state in which the embryos are stored. The state in which the state law that would apply to your family building would be the state wherein the clinic is at the time that you're doing the embryo transfer. Actually, and if you're in a surrogacy, so say you went to Connecticut to do your embryo transfers, and I help people move embryos literally all the time. In fact, I've even personally gone to the cryobank, strapped the tank in my front seat, and driven the tank to the clinic. So we move embryos all the time. There are terrific and reliable services that folks can move if you are in a state where you are restricted, like New York. So
yes,
cross state lines. You do your transfer in Connecticut if you're a New Yorker, but your surrogate happens to live in Massachusetts. Well, your surrogacy agreement is going to be written under Massachusetts law, so your New York creation of embryos becomes a non-issue.
That makes sense. Thank you. Thank you. And then I guess to piggyback that, what are the state legislation changes being done right now? Is there any advocacy work being done to help change the laws that are surrounded by commercial surrogacy?
Well, in the non-surrogacy-friendly states, I can tell you that my colleagues in each of these states is always working on progressive legislation. So in those states that are non-surrogacy-friendly, you can be sure there are a group of attorneys working on legislation that not only will allow for easier access to surrogacy family building, but, for example, in New York, we have legislation pending, the Child Parent Security Act. The Child Parent Security Act is a beautiful piece of legislation. It not only allows for commercial surrogacy in the state of New York, but it also defines what an egg donor is, what an embryo donor is, and what a sperm donor is. So it is a comprehensive piece of legislation, and we're hoping that it can gain some momentum and cross over into law. There's good legislation that's pending in New Jersey right now. There's good legislation that's pending across the country to fight these barriers to family building. And I guess Resolve is the best resource for that in terms of keeping track of what's happening in each state. Look, we're not going to see this stuff tackled on a federal level. This is really, really important stuff to all of us and the folks who are listening. It's probably the biggest. Certainly my infertility was the greatest challenge I have faced, and I'm about to celebrate my 50th birthday. So knocking on wood left, right, and sideways here, but certainly infertility was the biggest, greatest hardship I have felt, I have faced. But for folks who aren't touched by it, it's a non-issue, so I don't see this being addressed in federal legislation, so it's state-specific. But it's absolutely everybody listening should get involved with advocacy in their states to support assisted family building. And even those who aren't touched by infertility should be behind the effort.
I agree with you. And just kind of as a side, I actually work closely with Resolve, and just like Shweta mentioned, and I do federal advocacy work. But they do actually have Resolve, that is, has a grassroots advocacy project called Project Protect, where it's to address some of these issues on a state-by-state level. So, again, I echo what you said. I think that everybody should get involved with this. This is our right as an American citizen, and I think that we have – that's the beauty of being being in America, is the fact that we do have the voice, and we should use it. So,
agreed.
Yeah, and Amy, thank you very much. Just to be sensitive of everybody's time, I have a question for Helen.
Yep.
Helen, so one of the topics that my husband and I often write about is anxiety and how infertility can be such a huge catalyst for anxiety. After dealing
with that's today's understatement.
Yeah. After dealing with multiple failed cycles myself, I remember once being at a family event where there was an extremely insensitive pregnancy announcement. And at that point, we were very open about our the disease that we have. And despite of all of my husband's best efforts of trying to console me during that time, my husband had a very severe panic attack. Do you find that the husbands often face similar psychological effects because maybe they're bottling up those emotions to protect their wives?
And what happens when you bottle up anxiety is it's going to come out in some form or another. In your case, or in your husband's case, it came out in the form of the panic in that way. typically, the men want to protect the women and they don't let their feelings show. But there's a phenomenon that I've noticed that when the husband is a little boy, his dad is rather absent and the mother is rather histrionic, she has her needs that can't go in the appropriate place because he's either not around or he's dismissive of her, and she winds up treating the son as if he were a husband. And meanwhile, he's 6 years old, he's 8 years old. He's no more qualified for this than he is to fly to the moon without a rocket ship.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it sets up an anxiety about a woman who has emotional needs. And so fast forward now, he's in a marriage, happy-go-lucky, terrific, and boom, they're looking at a fertility struggle. And now she is appropriately needy, and he's back to the six-year-old who doesn't know what to do with his mother. So just from a psychodynamic point of view, you know, anxiety in men is both normal because he's anxious to become a parent as well, very often more so than the woman. I've heard some of that. But, you know, the thing with my field is that it's sometimes not easy to generalize because you have to know the psychodynamics of the people who are involved. And it sounds like the anxiety attack that your husband had is something that I can't really comment on because I don't know him. But it does sound like he has been had been a terrific support to you, and then it just went over the top. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the person who was insensitive that he wanted to, you know, poke his eyes out, you know, and didn't know, was holding back on those feelings as well. I can't comment as to why. I can say that, in a way, good for him, because he was letting it be known that he had needs. He may not have done it on purpose, but everybody is human, unless you're made of concrete, and there are people who try to do that one, too. But yes, the husbands are just as vulnerable as the women, you know, and they are no more exempt from the intensity of emotions than anybody else.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think you nailed it on the head. That pretty much summed up exactly what I feel that he was going through. And really, it was one of those things that we were that couple that realized that this was emotionally hard. We did have a great communication style.
Mm-hmm.
So communication, and I think that you made a great point at the beginning of this podcast, is so important. But even with that us having that powerhouse ability of being able to communicate, we seeked out a very great counselor. And
mm-hmm.
from the very beginning of our journey, we went to counseling. And
yeah.
that was such an integral part of us coping with infertility on a positive
yeah.
level and not necessarily on the negative side.
Yeah. Well, you know, we are, as human beings, we're organisms that have the environment and our world and whatever's going on in our world has impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
And if it goes in and it doesn't come out in the form of verbal or journaling or people who are athletes, joggers, you know, I've had so many women say to me, my doctor said I can't run. I don't know what I'm going to do. That's how I bust through all of my pent-up emotions. So if there's not a way to release this, then you become destabilized as a human organism. You know, I when I had my house, I had something called a trash masher, right? So instead of running down to the garbage every day, you put the wet stuff in the sinkerator thing, and you put the dry stuff in this thing, and then you pushed a lever, and it sounds just like the garbage trucks in New York City. You know, it compressed everything. And so you could take the garbage out once a week. Well, you know, we are human beings, and if we put garbage in and keep compressing it, there has to be some way to let it go, or there's going to be some kind of breakdown. And, you know, even couples who have fabulous modes of communication, I think you forestalled running into trouble because you recognized that what went in had to be released with this woman or man verbally, however the style of therapy was. You were taking care of not letting it all pile up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a good thing. And, you know, you certainly it's signs of discord would be a time to go. I don't think there's anybody, no matter how talented you are in communicating, who's going to go through this thing without being triggered, without being blindsided. I find that people vow that they're going to go through this and then they hit some kind of pothole. Certainly the inability to communicate sexually can be a real stumbling block. Not wanting to hurt each other and holding back in that way. I mean, so if you have guidance, you're going to be better off.
Yeah. I agree, and there's so much great information that we're giving out to all our listeners, but we do have 10 minutes left to the show, so we're going to carry it on, and we're going to give it over to Shweta, and she's going to give her final questions and wrap up the show here.
Thank you, Fran, and thank you, Helen and Amy. It was really enlightening to hear you both, and I'll really keep my question very brief. Helen, I'll start with you first. You wrote on your website, you can use your mind to change your brain. It would be great if you could explain it in a little more detail.
Yeah, well, I educate people as to the functioning of our mind-brain phenomenon, that we have a brain stem that controls all of the automatic functions like breathing and heart rate and blood pressure and muscle tension and
mm-hmm.
so forth. So let's call that the body. Then we have
mm-hmm.
the neocortex, which on a very simplified level we can say it's how we interface with the world, it's how we know what's going on, how we know what's impacting us. So let's call that the mind. And then we have between the two, the limbic brain, which contains structures, the amygdala and the hippocampus, which is sometimes called the emotional brain, and that's where memories and trauma are stored. And we can use our mind and decide to use our brain stem by breathing, voluntarily breathing long, slow, deep. And when we do that, the brain stem communicates with the limbic brain, and the limbic brain says to itself, well, if she's breathing like that, she's not in a foxhole, right?
Okay.
So we can address the trauma by behaving in a certain way that creates a relaxation. And much of what I teach in the mind-body classes has to do with how you can impact the midbrain, which is basically the troublemaker. Also, you can listen to guided imagery, which is a passive thing, because sometimes when you're in a frenzy, the last thing that you feel qualified to do is follow your breath, because your mind is going, you're never going to conceive, the IVF is going to fail, blah, 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 blah. You know, so it's hard to keep yourself narrowly focused on that which is a positive thing to do in order to reverse the physiology of stress. But even though we have a genetic, let's say, predisposition to be anxious, a genetic predisposition to be depressed, if you decide using your neocortex that this is not what you need at this phase in your life, in fact, it's the last thing you need, then you can elect to learn these mind-body techniques, which are extremely effective in getting you out of, you know, outer space and back into your body, where you can live in a way that pendulates, as I said before, the necessities of what you have to do to go through all of the fertility challenges, with deciding what you can do to enjoy your life and how you can be in a state of calm, which, by the way, those are the two major coping styles. One is, you know, what can I do, or problem-solving coping, and the other is how can I be in my skin. And the studies have shown that the letting go coping, being in your skin coping, has a positive correlation with rates of pregnancy. So people come into my classes, and I teach them these things, and they walk out the door greatly relieved because they no longer feel out of control. They may not go into their bedroom and come out pregnant like everybody else they know, but at least they're not a slab of meat with their legs in stirrups, feeling completely helpless and victimized by this whole process. So it's really very rewarding for me to be able to, you know, give people a way to participate in this as partners with their doctors.
Okay, great. You're just doing a great job helping these people, get instilling positivity in them. And I know that I'm glad to have a friend who did the same thing for me, and she just pulled me out of the depression that I was in at that time. Yeah, and she kind of used a similar techniques that you just described of meditation and practicing.
Yeah, I have
breathing
enormous,
in and out.
I have enormous amounts of free information on my website. It's www.mind-body-unity.com, and there are resources. In the resources tab, there's all kinds of articles. There's a blog. People can sign up for my free newsletter. I've been told that people who have read my book say just reading the book, they feel better. It's an enormous amount of information in there that helps people get into that state of neutrality.
Okay, that's great. That's great. Thank you so much, Helen.
Oh, it's
and
my pleasure.
I guess,
thank you.
Well, I have one question for Amy. I mean, I had several questions, but I guess we have to wrap up the show because we are just running out of time. Amy, I would like you to comment on three-parent IVF And what are the legal issues that one should be aware of regarding the three-parent IVF? If you could just briefly respond.
And I will briefly respond. And actually, it is an actual brief response. Fudge family building is not currently available in the United States. So to the extent that your programming is only reaching an American audience, it is not a family building option that is currently available. It is in intense ethical discussion right now. I don't foresee it becoming available anytime soon. In short, it is a process that has just been approved in the UK, whereby there are two sources for eggs, and if there has been determined a defect, a chromosomal defect in one, and I'm not a medical professional, so I'm probably saying this in a very crude way, but this is how I understand it. If there is a chromosomal defect in one, the physician or clinician is able to access a healthier egg, take from that healthier egg that which is the defect in the first egg, implant that into the first egg, introduce it to sperm for fertilization. So you've got chromosomal material from the healthy egg that has replaced the defective chromosomal material, joined with the sperm, and so you essentially have three gamete providers in the creation of embryos. But still extremely controversial here in the United States. I don't expect it for several years at least.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Amy.
I think it's just terrific programming. Thank you, Fran, and Shweta, and for my other guest speakers. You know what? I think together we put out some really good information. Let's let it go viral.
It was a very very comprehensive program. I was very impressed with the layout when you sent it to me, and listening to it is just really a useful and important thing, because this is science fiction, folks. And people need help with this kind of.
I think we could have spent a half a day on this conversation.
Continued.
And so much great information. So hopefully we continue the conversation on social media, and everybody gets all the great information they need.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much, Helen and Amy.
Okay.
It was such a wonderful discussion, and it was a pleasure having you both with us today. Fran, thank you so much for co-hosting with me, and I thank you and Candace both for supporting the discussion with your insightful questions. I'm sure the information and advice that we have given, that Amy and Helen has given on the show, would be a good resource and help many struggling with this grave but not so visible issue of infertility. And I thank the audience for their support, and we look forward to having you all join us for our next Cure Talks show next week. So please stay tuned and join us next week on 22nd of June 2015 at 6 p.m. Eastern to discuss challenges and changes in life after prostate cancer with Dr. Anne Hart. More information on this show and other upcoming shows is available on our website, www.curetalks.com, or you can email at priya@trialx.com to avail the information. The link for today's show will be sent in via email to all the participants. So until the next show, thank you very much, everyone.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye. Bye-bye.